Good morning. So last time we talked a bit about arrays in C++, which look very similar to arrays in Java, but we had two kind of big differences. So we could declare arrays of a fixed size, similarly to Java. That array existed as a local variable if this was in a function, or as a global variable otherwise, and just had that size, and you could access elements of it like you would in Java. But if you wanted a variable-sized array, we learned that you had to use new and delete, that we couldn't actually, in C++, allocate variable-sized arrays as a local variable normally. Instead, we need to use this new operator to allocate it some in the place where things stay around, which meant that we also needed to use this corresponding delete operator to get rid of it when we were done with it, or else we'd be wasting memory for that array even after we had no way of referring to it. We lost all our pointers to it. And we also learned from this that we could use a pointer to the first element of an array like an array. We could access elements of it using the same syntax we're used to from Java. Learn about references, which you can think of as pointers which you set when you create them and otherwise are always dereferenced all the time. So they're still a pointer, they still contain an address, but you can't actually get at that address directly. Instead, you just use the reference and it automatically dereferences it, goes to where that address points. And we briefly talked about one big use of this in C++, which is as function arguments. So you can have an argument to a function where the function changes the argument. And the way that actually works is that it takes a reference when you call it with a normal variable. It binds that variable to the reference, as in it takes the address of the variable behind the scenes and passes that address inside the reference to the function. And this lets us avoid using the address of operator to call a function which we want to change a value we're passing. It's commonly something you'll see in real C++ code. Yes?
So if you put in like a regular variable, will it take the address of that variable, or do you have to pass it in every address?
So the question is, if I have a function which takes a reference, x, and I pass foo a regular variable, regular int, what's going to happen? It's going to take the address of that regular int. Another way you can think of it is that x inside foo becomes another name for regular int. Okay, so any other questions on these topics? Okay, so a brief logistical note. At least one of your fellow students has assistance from the Student Disability Access Center, which requests note-taking assistance. So if you'd like to volunteer to provide notes to someone as a disability where this would be helpful, please go to the SDAX website. There's a note-taker application link. If you don't memorize this URL, you can talk to me after class and I can point you there. So, okay. And now we'll move on to our talking more about passing arguments to functions, first with a brief reminder. So I know from last time, we kind of ended with an example of the arrow syntax, and I wrote something and a bunch of people asked me what it was, which I didn't, think to emphasize it because we went over it earlier, but it's worth repeating because this, as you're gonna see in your next lab, comes up a lot as something that's useful, and that's that you can do the arrow syntax. This is the same as putting, dereferencing something, putting parentheses on it rather than putting a dot. And you're gonna do that a lot because, parentheses star p and parentheses dot print is really awkward to type for most people. So this, and a way you can remember it is that the arrow means to follow where the pointer points. Any questions about the syntax? Okay. So last time we finished up talking about different ways of passing arguments to functions. So we had our pass by, our standard, no notation, which meant that we had a copy made. So this didn't modify its argument. It modified its argument, didn't modify the thing that was passed in because we made a copy, and that's the fault in C++. So that was this primary use of references, that if we actually want foo to modify the thing that we're passing to it, we make it take in a reference that implicitly takes the address so it can modify the original value. And we can achieve this effect manually by passing in a pointer. And you might see some coding styles where they do this, even though they could use a reference, because they want to make it really, really clear people reading the code that this function is probably going to modify something. And so this was an example of taking a reference into a function because we would have needed a function to do something that wouldn't be possible if we made a copy. Where we wanted to modify some original thing, so we needed some way to get at that. And so either we need our caller to give us a pointer to it, or we need to take in a reference, so our caller always, without trying, gives us the address of it. Another use you'll commonly see for taking references as arguments to functions is to avoid copying. So when I talked about reasons for doing operator new earlier, I mentioned that when we return from functions, we make a copy. And if you want to return a big object, that sounds pretty expensive. You like to avoid that. A way you could avoid that is by allocating something with new, returning a pointer to it, then when we pass that pointer around, we're just copying an address, a single number, no matter how big the thing that address points to is. We're not making copies of it, we just have to remember to get rid of it. So for passing arguments to functions, you might want to pass a pointer in order to avoid copying the thing, but not because we actually care about modifying it. And this is a very common thing in C++, because we like passing classes around, and classes usually are pretty big. They might have lots of member variables. We don't want to have to copy 17 ints every time we call a function. We'd like to just have an address be sent, but many times we want the function really not to change the value. So a common idiom you'll see is that, we could write a function which just takes two instances of a class, but this is going to copy those to call the function. So we'll end up with a copy of the two instances. So what you'll commonly see instead, because we don't like making another copy in our local variables of the whole class and all its members, which would be more severe if it was something more complicated than rational, is that we'll take in a reference to a const instance. So this is still a reference, it still points to the original thing, but because we've indicated that it's const, the compiler is going to stop us from using the reference to modify the original thing. So that's what we're doing here. So we're saying, I want a reference, I don't want to make a copy, but I promise you, I'm not going to change it. I'm just doing this to save myself from copying. Yes?
When you copy the memory, the copy memory stay after the function completes?
The question is, when you make a copy, will the copy memory stay after the function completes? No, it's just like a local variable. It's going to go away when the function returns. So if you if less than copy took the address of its first, that address would be would no longer be a valid pointer after the function returned. Whereas if we took the address of first here, we get the address of the original thing in the caller's memory, and that would still be valid. Yes?
What happens if we declare something as constant and then try to change it inside the function?
So the question is, what happens if we declare something as constant and try to change it and set the function? So if you do something like this or this, examples, then you're going to get a compile time error. So here we have something which, this will modify the rational value passed in. This one will compile, The second one, this first broken one, where we cast in a copy of the value, it will compile, it will modify the copy, and then nothing happens, but it's going to compile. The compiler is going to be, yep, you can modify your copy, that's fine. And it's going to let you do that. If you mark it as const, this is still a copy, but the copy is marked as const. So we make the copy, and then the compiler is not going to let us modify it. So here, if we write value equals rational 4, 3, that's going to give us a compile time error. The compiler is going to say, you can't assign to a const name. I'm sorry. And in the second, last case, we're not going to make a copy, but we're going to have a reference, and it's going to be marked as a reference to a thing that can't be changed. So when we try to use that reference to modify it, the compiler is going to say, sorry, you're trying to modify a constant thing. I can't let you do that. And it's going to say that at compile time. And this is a very common use of const, is that we're just trying to make sure we don't accidentally modify something. Like, we could, in most of this code, usually change, get rid of the word const, and the code would still work exactly the same, but the advantage of having the word const there is that if we accidentally modify our argument that we, you know, want to point to the original thing, the compiler is going to complain, which is probably better than debugging the case where a function that's not supposed to modify something ends up modifying something, and you think the bug is in the code which is calling that function, as is, would be likely to happen. So any questions about any of these and what they do? Okay, so this last example is probably the most common use of references you will see. Just because it's kind of an idiom not to unnecessarily copy things and to sort of assume that you don't want to copy an arbitrary class. Obviously, if your class has only one member variable, that might not be worth it. That might be slower than if you then actually making a copy. So references are full-fledged things that can be used for more than local variables for toy examples and passing arguments to functions. So one thing you can do, which is not obvious, is yes, you can return a reference from a function. So here we have a global variable, and in some code we can call this function and get a reference to that global variable, and because the reference is sort of an implicitly dereference pointer, I can just assign to that reference. And then I can get the reference again, and I get the value of the variable. So you're probably not going to do this very much, but you might see some interfaces for class methods and such, which you take advantage of this. And like where you call a method and assign to it, this is usually what's happening. So that returns a reference, you're assigning to that reference. Yes? Yes.
But our return type is an reference.
Yes.
Does it get automatically converted when we return it?
Yes. So the question is, the return type is an int reference, but counter is an int. Does it get converted? Yes.
Okay.
So when we return, it has to create the object of the return type. So it initializes it to be based on counter, which means it takes the address of counter to construct the reference. Just like if we did int at ref equals counter. Yes? So the question is, you're guessing this is only work for global variables. So this will compile. This will compile, but no, it will not. It's not a good idea. It won't work. And the issue is that you're returning a reference to memory, a variable that no longer exists. It's the exact same problem as if we returned a pointer. Like, it's valid, it compiles, But immediately when you return it, the thing that the reference points to or the pointer points to no longer is there. You can't use the reference or pointer. So it needs to be a global variable or something allocated with new or something like that. And if it's something allocated new, this begs the question of how are you going to delete it? It seems a little tricky with the reference. So you probably shouldn't do that, but right, it could be legitimate to do. The most common case where you'll see this is, as I said, that sometimes classes will have a method which returns a reference. So you will assign to the result of a method in some libraries. I don't think we're going to do that here, but you might see it. And this, I think, helps you understand what references are versus pointers. So that there's a very closely equivalent to a pointer that you just reference all the time. And similarly, even more confusingly perhaps, you can have member variables that are references. That is actually legal to do. You probably should never do this. Like, probably not, but it's legal, it works. Note that I had to initialize it in my constructor initialization list, because remember what I said, once that references, you can't reassign where they go after you create them. So we need to set it in the initialization list of the constructor, otherwise it's too late. Otherwise we're trying to use the reference instead of initializing it. And we're gonna get a error because the reference doesn't point in. Isn't set. That will be a compile time error, in fact. Okay, so any questions about references? Okay. So for next topic, I'd like to talk about methods in classes that you don't write. So here is an empty class, foo. So it looks like foo has no member variables and should have no methods, but it has at least four methods. There might be a few others we're not going to talk about. And some of these you kind of make sense, like the first one. It has a default constructor. Well, that makes sense. If they don't define a constructor, there might need to be one. You can guess what would be in a default constructor. In this case, it probably does nothing. There's a few ones which are less obvious. So there's this copy constructor. So there's a constructor which takes a const reference to foo and does something, and that's, in this case, going to be written by our compiler for us. There's this method with a name that starts with a tilde and the name of the class, which is the destructor. We'll talk about what that does in a second. And we have this method with a name which contains an equal sign, method operator equals, which is the assignment operator. And this method takes an argument, which is a reference to a const foo, and returns a reference to a foo. So you notice here that in these implicit methods, C++ is really taking advantage of passing constant references in cases where it doesn't want to make a copy for some reason. So we're doing that in both of these. That's the reason we have a const reference, is to avoid making a copy. And that's sort of the standard convention for these methods, whatever we need a copy constructor for and whatever the assignment operator method does. So I'm going to start by talking about two methods. So first, the default constructor. That's pretty straightforward. And the destructor. So here's an example where we can see what's going on. So these are just methods that you can define yourself. So you've defined default constructors like in Java before. That makes sense. You can also define this destructor. So we declare that we have a public destructor. So tilde foo is the name, and we give an implementation of it. Like constructors, destructors have no return type. That's why I don't write void foo tilde foo. It's just there's no return type, just like a constructor. So there's nothing to return. And I can do whatever I want to do in my destructor, just like my constructor. In this case, I'm just printing out the name of the method that's being called. So here we have a local variable foo, and creating that local variable calls the default constructor. Calls the default constructor because I didn't specify anything else to do, any other way to construct it, so that's how it's going to be made. And then we have one printed out. Then we create a foo with a new operator. That also calls the default constructor because I didn't specify another way to call the constructor by adding parentheses here with arguments for a different constructor. So then we delete that foo we created. And deleting it, as part of getting rid of the memory, just before it does that, it's going to call the destructor. So we see we have a call to the tilde foo, the destructor method. And then we return from main, and just before main returns, we call the destructor of our local variable, local here. So every time we get rid of an object, just before we get rid of it, the destructor is called. And this includes local variables. The destructor is called just before we return from the function or the block where the variable is accessible. And for things we allocate with new, the destructor is called when we have the corresponding call to delete. It even happens for global variables. The destructor is called just before our program exits normally. So it's always going to be called when the object goes away and promptly. And this applies in pretty every case, really every case. So if we have an array of foos, that's going to construct three foos. So it calls the constructor three fine. We get rid of that array. Part of the reason the delete operator that takes square brackets is a bit different is that it's going to figure out how many times to call the destructor based on the size of the array. So in this case, we allocated a three-sized array, so it's going to call the destructor in each of the three foos. So a natural question to ask is, okay, so we have this destructor that's called automatically when objects go away. What is that actually going to be used for? And there are several common uses that come up all the time. So one is when you allocate memory with new. So for example, if I want to implement a dynamic array, such as the standard vector class we'll talk about later in C++, we might have a pointer, which remember, we can have a pointer that points to an array we allocated with new, and we need to get rid of that, or else we're going to waste memory. And, well, we're going to have this func method that's called whenever our dynamic array itself goes away, but if we don't do anything, that our compiler doesn't know that there's not another pointer to that array and that it should be kept around or not. So we need to tell it, yeah, when you get rid of dynamic array, also get rid of the thing that pointer points to. And we can do that with this destructor. So now when the dynamic array object goes out of scope, we'll get rid of the memory we dynamically allocated. And this is without needing to call some method to do that. You just have a dynamic array object as a local variable. When that local variable goes away because your function returns, you automatically get rid of the memory that was allocated. So any questions about this? Yeah?
Can you write multiple destructors, one with like different arguments and things like that?
So the question is, can you write multiple destructors? No. The destructor always takes no arguments. Yes?
Implement any of the implicit functions yourself and just left it all blank, what would happen?
So the question is, if I don't implement a destructor, what happens? So the default destructor, the one that you don't implement, is going to properly call the destructors and everything, and that's it.
How about the constructor? Does it just...
And same thing with the default constructor. Like, it's going to be the same as if you... So in both cases, it's going to be the same as if you wrote one, but it had an empty body. So if you don't write anything in your destructor, all the destructors of your member variables are called. If you don't write anything in the constructor, including an initialization list, all the default constructors are called. I would note that the destructor of an integer pointer doesn't do anything. So we actually do need to do this delete if you want it to happen. Yes?
So if we have a class that has member variables.
Yes.
And then we let the default constructor
Yes.
What will the default constructor do? Will it initiate some kind of value for the member variables?
So the question is, what does the default constructor do as far as setting the member variables? It's the same, so it's going to be the same as if you wrote an empty constructor. So here, if we had member variables, our default constructor is going to be the same as if we wrote this constructor. But really what you're asking, what's the default value of member variables? So it's the same as the default value of local variables. So it's going to call the default constructor if there's a meaningful one to call. For primitive types like pointers, integers, and so on, that the equivalent of the default constructor doesn't do anything. It leaves the memory as it is, even if it has junk values. So as far as things like our dynamic array class, this pointer here, if its constructor doesn't set it, it's going to be set to some junk memory, which may or may not be a memory address, and we definitely shouldn't use. But if you had a class member variable, it would call the default constructor if it had one. Yes?
Okay, so if we have a class called foo, and it's got one member variable, which is a feature called var, and we call the default constructor three times, there are three random bars with default values in the memory somewhere.
So your question is, you have a class foo, and you do, you have an int var, and the question is, what happens if you call the default constructor three times? So first of all, you are only allowed to call a constructor once per object, unless you destruct it first. So when you construct, the constructor is called when we create an object. You probably technically can call it manually, but you should not. You should only have it be called by the compiler when you create a variable or use new. If you create three different foos, yes. So if you have foo x, y, and z, this means there's space for three bars.
Okay.
And the default constructor will be called from foo, but the default constructor, given what I've written there, doesn't touch the memory at all. It just leaves the memory unchanged. If I wrote a new default constructor, which say set bar to zero, then yes, all the bars would be zero. Yes.
But in this example, you clear all the bars will just be set to random locations in memory, which may or may not.
Yeah. So all the bars will be at random locations in memory and will have whatever was there before. So usually there will be a pattern to the values, but it's not anything you can rely on. Okay. So other questions? Yeah. So the question is, do I have to destroy normal variables in the destructor? So the things you have to delete things you knew. For things which aren't created with new, then it's going to be gotten rid of for you implicitly. So I think I even have... later on I have an example of that, but not right here. But if foo had a So for example, if foo had a dynamic array member x, that x would be have its destructor called without us doing anything. Like whatever the compiler would add to would have a destructor which calls that destructor, and if we write our own destructor for foo, it's going to always call that even if we don't explicitly do it. The same way as if you had a local variable dynamic array, the destructor would be called. Okay, so this is deleting pointers that we knew is probably the most common reason you'd have to explicitly write a destructor rather than relying on the compiler doing it for you and getting it everything right. The other common reason was when you have some sort of system resources like files. So for example, the C++ standard library has a class called OFStream for output file stream for writing files, which looks very much like cout. And this is a valid use of it to write a file output.txt. And if you remember from Java, you probably had to close files. That was actually important. Here, I'm not closing the file, and that's fine, because when my variable out goes away, it calls the destructor. And the destructor of OFStream closes the file. So I don't actually need to worry about closing it manually. It's just going to happen automatically for me when the variable out is no longer accessible. So any questions on why we would use destructors and how destructors work? Okay, so I'm going to talk about the other two functions we saw that were in that class, which was the copy constructor, whatever that is, and the assignment operator. So let's go through this example here. So I'm going to have a class foo, which is what could just be that empty class I showed you earlier. So here I have create two foos, A and B. And that invokes the default constructor twice. If we didn't define a default constructor, the compiler gives us one which does nothing, or except make sure all the other constructors are called. Here, I'm creating a foo from another foo, and that uses the copy constructor. So the compiler's copy constructor is going to take the values in A and copy each member variable to copy one. So if we don't define our own copy constructor, the compiler would define one with this signature that just copies each member variable one by one. And in fact, when you do this syntax, which looks like you're creating copy two and then assigning to it, that's not what it does. Because we're setting the initial value that actually calls this constructor. It does not create a foo with the default constructor and then assign to it. Because this is the first value of foo. And this holds true in general. So if I do foo x equals 10, this is going to try to call a constructor with this signature. And if it doesn't exist, the compiler is going to give me an error, you can't do that. So the default copy constructor will make this work like you expect as far as copying the values from one to the other, like you would sort of from Java intuitively expect this to do, knowing that foo is a value, not a reference. So then we have this assigning two foos to each other. And you expect this to just copy the values from A into B, and that's what it does by default. So it copies each member variable from A into B, one by one. And the way this actually works, it invokes this funnily named function, which is defined by the compiler and part of foo. So operator equals sign. So name, because it's the equal sign operator. And you can, in fact, call that manually. Not that you ever would, but that is legal syntax that will call that, is another way to call that function. These are exactly equivalent. And the compiler will define an implementation of operator equal that just copies each member one by one. Yeah?
Could we use the operator syntax to like overload our own operators?
Question is, can you use the operator syntax to make your own operators? Yes, we will get to that in a bit. Okay. So the default implementation is to be more concrete. So for a rational class, if we don't define one, this is what the default implementation will do. We'll just assign each of our member variables. It actually does this at construction time, not afterwards, so it's like an initialization list, but basically just takes each member variable, assigns it. Our operator equals the default for that, just copies each member one by one, assigning them. And then returns a reference to itself. The reason it does that is so you can do this syntax, which parses like this. You don't do that very often, but that's why whenever you see in real code an operator equals define, it almost always ends with return star this. Is to allow you to do that. Otherwise, that would actually be an error. You can actually return like void, in which case that won't compile. So any questions on these? So why is there two separate functions that do the same thing? So where this starts, where the differences matter are when we have something, well, so to give an example, let's say dynamic array. So for dynamic array, we actually want to allocate new memory for the pointer. And we're going to probably not want to default initialize our dynamic array. We want to do something different when we're copying to create the new one versus assigning. So that would be an example where you might want to do something slightly different, even though the conceptual effect is the same. And that comes up a bunch. The other case is that you might have objects which you don't allow to change after they're created, in which case you might define a copy constructor but not an assignment operator. You might make the assignment operator explicitly not work. And the most common way of doing that is to make it private. In which case, trying to assign from it from outside the class will give an error. Okay, any other questions on these? Okay, and so as I mentioned earlier, the default implementations, and whenever you define a constructor or destructor, the constructor always constructs all the member variables. And the destructor always destructs all the member variables. So this means, for example, here we have a class bar which contains a foo. Allocating and deleting bars does the same thing for the inner foo as far as calling constructors and destructors. And this would be true even if we define our own constructor and destructor for bar. Even though we don't explicitly write it, the compiler inserts calls to the constructor and destructor of foo for us. So any questions on this? Hopefully this clears up what I meant by it's always called. So a note on default constructors. I think this is the same as in Java. If you define a constructor that takes arguments, then the compiler will not create a default constructor for you. So here I have a foo where I have one constructor that takes arguments. If I try to create a foo without providing those arguments, the compiler is going to say, sorry, that constructor doesn't exist. And the rule is that there's no implicit default constructor if you define any other constructor. So if you want a default constructor and you define some other constructor, you need to write a default constructor even if it does nothing. So that's a reason why you might need to write this empty constructor I have for bar here in real code. But the copy constructor and operator equals do exist, yes. Yes. So a typical pattern you'll see to get rid of those is to have them be marked as, is to define them but make them private. They won't exist if you have member variables which themselves don't have a copy constructor or a assignment operator. And the reason is that I kind of fudged what the real default copy constructor looks like, which is that it will actually do, it will actually call the copy constructor of each of the member variables. Yeah.
Is that true of all four, that if you have a member variable that's missing the method, it won't do it for the class?
So the question is that true of all four? It's true, it's not true of destructors, because you can't have a variable without a destructor. It is true of destructors, okay. Yeah, I think it's true of all four. Not having a destructor is really weird and you probably should never do it. But I guess you can have all the destructors be private, in which case you can't delete the top object, which is weird. You can new it, but not delete it. That would be very strange, but I think that is legal to do. Yeah, and the reason why is because the versions the compiler generates need to call those things, so they don't compile that way, so they can't exist, or at least can't be used. Okay, so we have our functions. So let's go back to operator equals. So here is an example of me defining my own operator equals, which doesn't do something sensible. I just print out a message and do something. And that will work, it will call it, and we can see that. And we don't have to make the equals operator do a normal thing, because I can write whatever code I want there, and I can do that even if there are member variables in foo that I probably should be assigning. I am not obliged to make my operator equals do something sensible. Now, if you don't do this, people using your class are probably going to be really confused. But we can do whatever. We can have it say increment account. We can even take a type which is not a type which would naturally be assignable. Works. So the operator equals I showed you doing assignment is just a general case of support for overriding operators. So basically, anytime we have a class, we do equals something, that's equivalent to calling the operator equals method. And it just takes whatever type is there and looks for something with matching types. So in this case, we have something which takes a bar, even though bar is unrelated to foo, and it doesn't change count. The way by like copying it from bar, it just increments it. And that is completely legal for us to do. And this feature is used a lot in C++, including some cases you've seen before. So if you remember how I showed you how to do input and output, it looked like C++ had invented this special syntax for input and output, which was unlike anything you could do anywhere. Now, something you've never seen. It's just a case of this same principle. So just like we can have operator equals defined, we can define all the other operators, and the and this double less than and double greater than, this is left shift and right shift. These are operators that exist for integers in Java, for example, not that you've used them. So they're just operators that are normal integer math operators that we have redefined what they mean, because using them on a class always calls the method by that name. And that's how cout and cin work. So cout foo here calls this operator less than function on the O stream, which takes in a const char star, which is the type of that string constant. And similarly, when we do cin to read into a number, we have an operator greater than, which takes in a reference to an int. Since it's a reference to an int, we can modify that int, and that's how we are able to read into, in this case, the variable number. And you could, in fact, do write, instead of this, cin dot operator number. You could write a method call by hand, though obviously probably don't want to do that as far as readability goes. And this also happens with the string class, which we'll talk about more later. So in Java, you're used to concatenating strings with the plus operator, and in Java, that's kind of a special case. Like, no other class can really get access to that. There's some special class in java.lang, which lets you do this plus thing to concatenate into strings. Here, it's just a call to this operator plus. So we have two strings from the string class, and we add them together, and that calls operator plus, which is just a method that returns a new string. If we do plus equals to add onto a string, that calls operator plus equals, which is just a method which appends to a string. So, any questions on these examples? Question is, how is plus plus count different than count plus plus? So plus plus count is, this is increment and return the new value. So that's why the first one outputs one and not zero. Unlike with count plus plus, where it would output zero. Another common use you'll see of using operators on classes call these methods is to make arithmetic work. So if we don't want to write dot times and dot plus with our rational class, we can just define the plus and times operators, and then everything works kind of like they were floats. Except I wrote the wrong prototype for these. Okay. This should be like this. Sorry. Because obviously we don't have a, it's not, we want to call with two things, not three. I was thinking about a future slide. Okay. So this general principle holds that, you know, when we have an operator, it's like calling a method. And that's the typical case, that we'll have methods defined for what we want it to, what do we want to happen when we try to use an operator, which otherwise would not make any sense on a class. We can also do this with a function, which is why I was confused there. So you can have a function defined, and the compiler will also look for these functions, and whichever one it finds, it will call. So in this case, when you have string and cout, there's a function, and the reason why it's a function is because this is defined in the string header, not the IOStream header. And when you include IOStream, it wants it to be the case that you don't have to include string. So it can't be a method because of that. So it's just a function outside the class, but that also gets called. The compiler looks for either a method or a function to call named operator and whatever the symbol for the operator is. And that's what I have for today. We'll finish up talking about C++ next time.